Chapter 18. The Shepherd's Crown. There was the face of Rob Anybody, and he said, "The scanners are breaking through, Mistress Tiffany. It's started." "So, cry Crivens and let loose the Clan MacFeagle," Tiffany commanded, as a small group of Feagles scrambled out from under the bed, from where they had been watching over her. One of them appeared to have been hiding in her boots. He was now punching at the laces with a cry of, "Tack that, you nasty, wriggling little bogles!" Boots, Tiffany thought. I wish I had brought Granny Weatherwax's boots to wear for this fight. They would have given me strength. And then she stopped this thought. No! This is my land, my turf, my feet, my boots, my way. But she still scolded herself as she struggled into her dress and thought that she should have slept with her day clothes on. What kind of leader are you? As she stumbled to pull on her boots, she felt a weight in the deep pocket of her fine black dress, and she pulled out the shepherd's crown, which she thought she had put on the shelf. Had she put it there herself earlier that night, ready for this moment? And to the moon she said, "What is the shepherd's crown? Whom does the shepherd's crown serve?" And the answer dropped into her head, "Tiffany Aching, land under wave." She twisted a thong of leather rapidly around the flint and hung it around her neck. She would go into battle with its power at her heart, she thought, the power of generations of Achings, of Granny Aching, of the shepherds of all time. Then she ran down the darkened stairs and out of the door, locking it behind her, and was not surprised to see you, the cat, perched on the front of her broomstick, purring and looking smug, while Nightshade was stumbling from the barn, wee Mad Arthur at her side. Then she was flying through the silvery night, the elf Nightshade clutching at her waist, Feagles hanging on to the bristles, and the owls following behind her, a squadron of feathered allies. Over in Lanka, Nanny Ogg was sleeping, and her snores could have cut timber. Suddenly there was a mild explosion which might be called a grumph, and the cat, Grebo, woke up and sniffed the air. Nanny had been sleeping in her day clothes. After all, she thought, who knew for sure when the elves would come? She shouted, "Grebo, ring the castle bell!" The cat was suddenly not there, but there was a blur of cat travelling at speed up to the castle, Grebo's unmistakable smell lingering in the air behind him, and when the guard saw him coming towards him, he ran after him into the bell tower. And as the great castle bell tolled, light blossomed throughout the castle as candles were lit in every window, followed very shortly by the rest of Lanka town. The bell! What danger was this? In the royal bedchamber, Queen Magrat nudged her husband, who was still rubbing his eyes, and said, "Fairest dear, help me buckle my escutcheon, will you, my dear?" The king sighed. "Look, why can't I go with you? It's going to be dangerous." Magrat smiled, the smile that you gave loving but occasionally annoying husbands. This was old ground. "Well, someone has to be left at home," she said. "It's like chess, you know. The queen saves the king."
"Yes, dear," said the king, and opened the cupboard that contained the armour of Queen Inki. Inki had been the most fearsome warrior queen Lanka had ever seen. Well, so the stories said, as she hadn't actually existed. But the people of Lanka hadn't let a tiny thing like that stop them adding her to their history, and so a set of armour had been made to go along with a portrait. Magrat had worn the armour the last time she faced the elves, and it seemed only right to wear it again. As the door opened, Magrat thought she heard a subtle little sound of a call to arms. Queen Inki's armour had a life of its own, and it always shone even in the dark. Verence helped her buckle on the male armour, which she secretly thought of as female. Then she slipped her feet into the heavily-soled spiked sandals and topped it all off with the winged helmet. The last piece to go on was the leather baldric. Verence wanted to embrace her, but he thought, "I won't. There were too many spikes in any case." But he loved his wife to distraction, so he tried again to volunteer himself to be somewhere in the coming fray. "Magrat, my love," he murmured, "it seems so shaming if the king can't fight." "You are a very good king, Verence," his wife said firmly, "but this is witch's work, and someone has to look after the people and our children." The queen, Magrat as was, staggered under the weight of the armour, and under her breath she whispered a little magic. "Queen Inki,
Queen of Queens, make your armour light. And suddenly she felt strong, stronger than she had ever been before. She picked up a crossbow in one hand, her broomstick in the other, and almost flew down the stairs to the great hall, where the other witches, who were for the most part en déshabillé, stared at her with wild surmise. Wild surmises take on many shapes, and every witch, some still in their underwear, stared at the queen, and the surmise each gave her hung there in the rafters. In the voice of Queen Inky, Magrat shouted, "Up, girls, and at 'em! It's started, ladies, so get your heavy-duty knickers on and your sticks ready!" She glared at the only witch to be fully dressed, spick and span in 3 minutes, to the surprise of all. "That means you too, Mrs. Earwig!" There was a little commotion at the back of the hall, then a sudden crash, and a group of witches ground to a halt. "What's happening?" Magrat cried, still in the voice of Queen Inky. "It's only long, tall, short, fat Sally. She's got 2 feet down one knicker," said Mrs. Proust. Surrounded by witches, long, tall, short, fat Sally, small and squat right then, like a low-lying thunderstorm, was swiftly put back on her feet. Mrs. Earwig looked rather smug and said, "I've been looking at my charts. The omens are good." "Well, omens are 10 a penny, said Mrs. Proust. "I've got lots of them. After all, we are all witches." And the ghost of Queen Inky filled Magrat, who said, "Let us fly." In Mr. Sideways's old barn, Mephistopheles laid a hoof gently on Geoffrey's sleeping form. Geoffrey jumped out of the straw and discovered that the old boys who had readied themselves for the coming battle by bivouacking in the barn with him were already up and about, creaking a bit and making their toilet in a bucket. Geoffrey looked at the old men. They had spent most of the evening carousing and telling stories of the days when they were all young and handsome and healthy and didn't have to pass water far too often. They had managed to make their wives give them a ticket of leave, and said wives had been given to believe that their husbands were just in the barn for a few drinks and reminiscences. The wives, as wives do, had festooned their menfolk with big scarves, mittens on strings, and woolly hats, with, alas, pom-poms on the top. Captain Makepeace, the old boy's acknowledged military leader, said, "It's time to go and get out, laughing boy's confounded contraption." Geoffrey looked at the captain's warriors and sighed internally. Could they do it? They were old men. Then he thought, yes, they are old men. They have been old men for a long time, which means they have learned many things, like lying and being crafty and, most importantly, dissembling. "We shall fight them on the mountains. We shall fight them on the rocks. We shall fight them over the hills and down in the valleys." There was plenty of all those to pick from in Lanka, so he had a good choice of battlegrounds, as long as they were all up and down. "We shall never surrender," Captain Makepeace roared, and there was an answering cheer. "They will not like it up and over 'em," Smack Tremble called out, waving what looked like a rusty bayonet in the air and worryingly living up to his name. "They will not like it. Oh, no, they won't." Mephistopheles grunted as Geoffrey hitched him to his little cart, which the old boys had filled with mysterious bags before drinking the night away, and the two of them followed the old men out of the barn. Captain Makepeace didn't need to tell his men to be stealthy. They already were. It was running fast that would be a problem. And stealthily they made their way into the wood and further on to where they had hidden Mr. Sideways's contraption, camouflaging it with branches. Geoffrey watched them pull Mr. Sideways's project out into the clearing. It stood there, looking ominous, surrounded by the bushes, waiting its moment, like a huge insect, one with a nasty sting. Up by the circle of stones called the Dancers, Lord Lankin was exulting. His elves were dancing around the stones, flitting in and out, and metaphorically tweaking the noses of the piper, the drummer, the leaper, the best-known stones. The power of the gate was weak, and the glamour of the elves was fearsome. "They are not even here waiting for us," Lord Lankin gloated. "Stupid humans! If we go down through those woods, we could be out into the centre of Lanka in one great charge, and the moon is full and on our side." And in the silver moonlight, the elves, some on horseback, bells jingling and harness tinkling, made their way down the hill towards the woods. But as they neared the edge of the trees, Lankin saw a young human boy step out onto the path with an animal by his side. It was a goat. "Who are you, boy?" he demanded. "Move aside! I am a prince of the elves, and you are in my way. Move, lest I show you my displeasure." Well, said Geoffrey, I don't see why I should. My advice to you is to turn round, sir, and go the other way, or else it will all be the worse for you. Lord Lankin laughed out loud. We will take you away, boy, and the things we will use on you when we get you back home will be incredibly nasty. Your torment for naysaying a prince of the elves. But why, sir? I mean no harm to you. I have no weapons. Can we be calm about this? It would appear that I have made you unhappy, and for this I am sorry. Geoffrey paused. He was trying to weave a peace between them, but it was like trying to get a rock to agree with a hard place. Surely both of us are civilized people, he finished. Lord Lankin screeched, Now, young man, you have trodden on the tail of the snake. Geoffrey calmly said, I believe this is not the case. I know you, mister. I know what kind of thing you are. You are a bully. I know about bullies. Oh, yes, I do. I have known them all my life, and believe me, you aren't the worst.
You are nothing, boy. We'll kill you anyway. And why a goat, may I ask? They are stupid creatures.
Geoffrey found his calmness floating away. He was worthless, a maggot, a ne'er-do-well. He felt powerless, a baby again. And as the elf spoke, in Geoffrey's mind an echo came. Even if I let you live, you will amount to nothing. This time it was the voice of his father, and he stood there frozen. The elf prince said silkily, Are you crying, you little baby? No, said Geoffrey, but you might be. For now his eyes had caught the flash of red fox fur swinging on its leather thong across the lord's chest, and he felt a rage beginning to build. We are not here for your sport, he stated, throwing the glamour from his mind with a huge effort of will. He clicked his teeth, and Mephistopheles was on the elf. It was a ballet with speed. The mince of darkness pirouetted to dangerous effect. He used his teeth first, then kicked hard with his legs, and ended by using his horns. Lord Lankin was spinning, kicked and tossed into the air from all directions, and the other elves drew back to keep out of the range of the maelstrom. And Geoffrey said to the battered prince, You are just a trickster, and I have found your trick. He shouted, He's down, gentlemen! Time to put him out! The branches parted, and there was a twang as Mr. Sideways yelled, Keep your hats on, boys! Cover your eyes! And the contraption sang, swinging up into the air, filling it with a twinkle of swarf and terrible death that came from nowhere to shower over the elves. Smack Tremble cheered, They don't like it up and over 'em! Oh, no, they don't! Swarf! Said Nanny Ogg, approvingly, from one side of the woods, where she and some of the other witches were waiting, prepared for what Captain Makepeace had called a pincer movement, with Mrs. Earwig and more witches on the other side. Pieces of iron, Nanny told the witches with her. Very small, very clever. Throw it down on elves, and they're in a world of hurt. Tiny bits of iron everywhere, and, I stress, everywhere. The Lanker stick-and-bucket machine sang again and again, and each twang was followed by the war cries of ancient battles, rivalling those of the Feagles. On this day of days, the old boys were younger than they thought. And the elves were, indeed, down and out, screaming from the pain of the terrible metal that stripped their glamour away from them, leaving them writhing. Many dragged themselves away back up the hill towards the dancers, while any who had escaped the reign of Swarf now found themselves sandwiched by the witches. From one side, Magrat piled in to make life unlivable for those remaining, her armour shielding her from their glamour, while her crossbow shot deadly arrows at them, and fire flew from her fingertips, forcing those who had ridden into battle on yarrow stalks to fall from the sky as flame destroyed the stems. From the other side, the elves were assaulted by Mrs. Earwig, and they really didn't know how to deal with her. She was shouting at them like some horrible headmistress, and they couldn't get through to her. She was impervious to their glamour. She also had an umbrella which she had opened, and it was amazing how much of a problem it was for the elves, its metal spokes poking at them, hitting tender spots. "This lady is not for turning," Mrs. Earwig boomed. She rose among them like a whirlwind, and as they were floored, long, tall, short, fat Sally became very fat and heavy and sat on them, bouncing up and down. While Mrs. Proust hurled her novelties that now worked as advertised over the elves, trapping them in curls of spells that seized their glamour and took it for their own.
The younger witches were in and out of the melee, diving from the skies on their broomsticks, throwing spells at every elf they saw, fire burning them where they stood, wind blowing dust into the horses' faces, madness into their minds, such that the horses reared, throwing their elvish riders to the ground. Then there was the crunching as Nanny Og came to the fore with her big, big boots, the ones with nails everywhere. Petulia was face to face with an elf, and a different kind of battle was going on as the elf threw its glamour towards her, sparkling shards of glamour shining in the air between them, and Petulia fought back with her soft voice and strong will, her words hypnotic, irresistible, boring the elf as she bored her beloved pigs, lulling it until it dropped dramatically at her feet.
"Ha! Easier than pigs," was Petulia's response. "Less intelligent."
And she turned to the next opponent. And in a lull, there was Hodgesarg, with his favourite gerfalcon on his wrist, the Lady Elizabeth, a descendant of the famous Lady Jane. He slipped the hood off, and the bird joyfully hurled herself into the fray, hitting the nearest elf between the eyes with her sharp talons. Then her beak got to work. And when it came to it, the battle for Lanka was over quite swiftly. Queen Magrat had all the surviving elves brought before her. "Even the goblins are smarter than you. They work with us these days," she told them, standing tall and strong in her spiked armour, the wings on her helmet silvered in the moonlight. "We have had enough of this."
"You could have had it all. Now, go away to your forlorn spaces. Come back as good neighbours, or not at all."
The elves cringed, but Lord Lankin, his warrior garb now only rags and his body blooded by the terrible swarf, hissed in defiance at them as he crawled away.
"You may have won this battle," he snarled, "but not the war, for our Lord Peasblossom will yet make this world bow down to us."
And then they were gone. Nanny Og said seriously, "It seems to me, girls, that it goes like this. We fight the elves at every turn, and they is always coming back. Perhaps it might be a good thing to keep us on our toes, to stop us from getting lazy, to put us on the anvil, so that we remembers how to fight. And at the end of time, living is about fighting against everything." She laughed, however, when she heard the old gentleman coming up the hill, singing, "There was a young lady from Quirm whose thighs were exceedingly firm," and the rest of the song helpfully disappeared as the captain remembered just in time how that verse ended. Captain Makepeace leaned over to Nanny Og and said, "They came through the dancers, right? Let's put a ring of swarf all around the stones. That would be the end of their fun. They would be locked out forever."
"Well, I reckons it would be a good start," said Nanny.
But Lord Lankin had one thing right. The elves might have lost the battle in Lanka, but the war was not yet over. For, many miles rimwards, Lord Peasblossom had indeed ridden through the stone circle on the chalk, with a band of elite warriors at his back. The Feagle Mound was one big scuttle as the Nac Mac Feagles turned out of every nook and cranny to fight. Everywhere was heat and noise. You could call it something like an overgrown termite mound. Not in front of the Feagles, unless you liked picking your teeth up from the ground, but there was the same bustling. It could even be said that the vanguard was steaming along, but these being Feagles, there were squabbles in the ranks, which, as everyone knew, was just the way of the clan. When Tiffany arrived at the mound with Nightshade, the throng spread out in the direction of the stones. The gateway had fallen to the elves, who were now heading towards them, a glorious band of lords and ladies resplendent in the moonlight. The air was thick with their glamour. Miss Tick was waiting. A Miss Tick with a board propped up on a few sticks she had handily knotted together to create a trestle. And on the board was written PLN. With a teacher's determination not to let anything interrupt her in the midst of any kind of lesson, her insistent voice was demanding the younger Feagle's attention as she tied a strange net, a tangle of intricate, carefully woven knots and loops, to her broomstick.
"Remember, I want you to keep it in one piece," she was saying sternly.
Then, within minutes, it was a melee. In fact, a melee of melees. There was a sting in the air, and Tiffany recognised the surge of static electricity. How could the elves be so stupid, she thought, as to attack in the midst of a storm? Did they not remember how she had used thunder and lightning to defeat them before? The sky was crackling, The hairs on her head tingled. She could see signs of a coming downpour happening everywhere, could recognise the build-up to an enormous storm. As awfully wee Billy Big Chin's mousepipes screeched out a battle hymn, pitched perfectly to assault the elven ears, there was a distant scream from a train at Two Shirts. A roar of iron and steel, a bellow that shouted, "This is no world for elves!" Feagles and elves were fighting now, with no quarter given on either side. Tiffany could see that the Feagles were dealing with things in their own special way, which included getting into the elves' clothing and fighting them from within. If there was something that an elf really hated, it was to have their clothing torn, and a black eye didn't do much for the image either. You can't be suave with a black eye, Tiffany thought. She suddenly burst out laughing. It had been a long time since she had set eyes on Horace the cheese. Horace was a cannibal cheese, an adopted member of the Feagle clan, but now she saw him rolling heavily over every fallen elf, and when they were flattened, the younger Feagles got to work as well, mostly with their heavy boots, but also with their double-the-fun clubs that curled in the air, clonking elves on the head and then coming joyfully back for another go. And yes, there was Maggie in their midst, a Feagle daughter fighting alongside her brothers, and indeed fighting even more furiously than her brothers. Tiffany thought, she's like a small Inky. The Feagle maid had been waiting for something like this to prove herself, so woe betide any elf who got in her way. It was one small step for a Feagle lassie, but a giant step for all Feagle womenfolk. Miss Tick was flying overhead now, the strange rope net hanging beneath her broomstick filled with young Feagles. As she pulled at one knot after another, the wee free men were tumbling out to fall smack on the heads of the elves below. Crash, whack, crump, followed by arg from the elves. And the witch had small bottles with her too, concoctions mixed in her caravan that she was now gleefully emptying over the heads of the elves' horses as she swooped above them. There was a moment's pause as each horse absorbed the mixture, then its eyes crossed, followed rapidly by its hooves, and it toppled to the ground, losing its footing, hurling its rider onto the earth to be quickly covered by Feagles. Letitia had arrived now, summoned by Hamish, and was tumbling from her horse, determination in her face, borrowed chainmail over her dress. She somehow flowed through the elves. There was a certain magic to it, as if she were some goddess of water, streaming everywhere, no thought to it, but no stopping it either. Suddenly the elvish horses still standing were bogged down in a quagmire, and the Feagles were there on hand to keep them in the mire. Nevertheless, it looked as if the Feagles, Miss Tick and Letitia, were really not getting the better of the elves. Despite the wee free men's pouring into elvish underwear and tearing it up, Tiffany realised that the knack-back Feagles were actually in danger of losing. Nightshade pointed out Peaseblossom sitting on a black charger, and Tiffany flew down to confront the leader of the elves. His minions scattered as she arrived. They had seen the expression on Tiffany's face. Peaseblossom was laughing. "Ah, the little country girl, how pleased I am to see you." She felt the tug of his glamour, but rage was a useful tool, and she hated that grinning face. It was so self-centred. It loved itself beyond any other thing. "Peaseblossom is a very stupid name for an elf of your size," she said, rather childishly. And then, suddenly, the elf had sprung from his horse to stand before her, a sabre in his hands, and his laughter was gone, only evil in his eyes. A voice said, "Don't touch her, Peaseblossom." And Nightshade was stepping forward, her glamour fully restored and shining gloriously, her hair streaked, silver with the moonlight, her new wings resplendent. She held herself like a queen again, her gaze slowly moving over the warriors behind her treacherous lord. And such was the power of her presence that even the Feagles paused in the frozen silence. "Why do you follow this perfidious elf?" the queen demanded of the elves. "I am your rightful queen, and I say that you do not have to do this. There are other ways." She spun on the spot, her velvet robe spiralling around her slim body. "I have learned this, and this girl," she pointed at Tiffany, "is my friend." Tiffany couldn't stop what happened next. "Friend?" Peaseblossom spat.
There are no friends for elves.
He raised his arm, and his sabre tore through Nightshade with a terrible swishing sound. The elf queen fell, crumpling to the ground at Tiffany's feet, where she writhed for a moment that seemed to last a lifetime, myriad faces and shapes appearing and disappearing, flickering in and out of substance, before finally lying still a forlorn heap. Tiffany reeled back in shock. Peaseblossom had killed the Queen of the Fairies. Worse, he had killed her friend. Peaseblossom, revelling, turned to Tiffany, his face sharp and merciless.
"You have no friend now."
Suddenly the air was full of ice. "You killed one of your own to get to me, you cursed elf," Tiffany said, her voice cold, red-hot anger boiling inside her. She wanted to explore a new way, an alliance of humans and elves, and now you have killed her.
"You stupid little girl," Peaseblossom taunted. "You think you can stand against me? What a fool you are! We elves knew well of the witch who once walked the edges of this world, but you are just a child, filled with pride because you were once lucky against a failing queen."
He glanced contemptuously down at the little heap that had once been the Queen of Fairyland.
"And now I will see you dead, alongside your friend."
He spat out the last word, and his glamour snaked towards her, creeping into her head, into her thoughts. Tiffany recoiled, a memory of Nanny Ogg's voice suddenly saying to her, "Granny Weatherwax said to me, 'As you is the one who's to deal with the future, and being young means you've got a lot of future.'" Well, it looked like Granny Weatherwax might have been wrong. She didn't have much future to come. She had failed everyone. She had tried to be the witch for 2 steadings and let everyone down. She had gone to see the King of the Elves. He had turned her away. She had made a friend of Nightshade. Now the Elf Queen was dead. She was facing a powerful elf lord who would kill her. She deserved to die. She was alone. Then it came to her. She did not deserve to die. And she was not alone. She never would be. Not while her land was beneath her boots. Her land. The land of the Achings. She was Tiffany Aching, not Granny Weatherwax, but a witch in her own right. A witch who knew exactly who she was and how she wanted to do things. Her way. And she had not failed because she had barely begun. She stood tall, frosty, furious. "You call me a country girl," she said, "and I will see to it that the country will see you dead." The land was speaking to her now, filling her up, throwing the glamour of the elf lord aside as though it were nothing, and the air crackled like lightning. Yes, she thought, thunder and lightning. The 2 dogs were long gone, buried in the hills alongside Granny Aching, but their strength was with her, and she was standing firm, her feet on the turf, the murmur of the ancient ocean below swelling through her souls. Earth, water. She raised her arms. "Thunder and lightning, I command you. Fire and air." As she drew on the power of the 2 sheepdogs, there in the air was a flash of lightning, a rumble of thunder. The shepherd's crown glowed golden on her breast. At the heart of it all, the soul and centre of her being, the golden light rising from the apex to surround her, protect her, add its energy to her own. And the sky broke in half. Never had there been such a storm. It was full of vengeance, and the elves were running, or rather trying to run, because the Feagles were in their way, and the wee free men had no liking for the elves. In the carnage and the shouting, it seemed to Tiffany that she wasn't in charge anymore. She was just a conduit for the wrath of the chalk. The land under her feet was trembling, shaking like a wounded animal on a leash, yearning to be free, and the shepherd's crown was shining like a living thing in front of her. A shepherd's crown, not a royal one. A crown for someone who knew where she had come from, a crown for the lone light zigzagging through the night sky, hunting for a single lost lamb, a crown for the shepherd who was there to herd away the predators, a crown for the shepherd who could work with the best sheepdogs any shepherd could possibly have, a shepherd's crown. And she heard again that voice. Tiffany Aching is the first among shepherds, for she puts others before herself. A king of shepherds? No, a queen. She felt she needed to apologize to the crown, apologize for letting these elves come through and threaten this land, and so she said in a whisper, I am Tiffany Aching, and my bones are in the chalk. Let the chalk be cleansed. And the world changed. In the city of Ankh-Morpork, Hex spat out a calculation for Ponder Stibbons, and he saw that an answer was underlined. A prayer wheel spun in the monastery of Oidong, and the monks bowed down in gratitude. While a little boy took his mother's hand in the travelling now and said, Mummy, Big Nasty's all gone. He had a wooden chain in his other hand and a little backpack of tools over one shoulder. Perhaps he will be an engineer in this new world when he grows up, his mother thought. And in Fairyland there was a sudden twang, as if a strand connecting the two worlds had suddenly snapped. There was fighting still going on. It was hard to stop the Feagles once they got going, and Tiffany walked through it as if in a dream. The elves were trying to get away now, but the ground seemed to hold them down, and she whispered, I ask the chalk, deliver to me the king of the elves. The heavy dance of the land now had a different tempo. Dust flew out, and there came suddenly the king of the elves, the stink, and his long hair and antlers were unmistakable. Oh, that stink! It had a life of its own, but in a way, Tiffany thought, it was a male stink of life. The huge body loomed over her. How now, Mistress Tiffany? I can't say well met again, said the king, but I must confess to surprise. You surprised me before, he mused, with the gift you left me. A shed? What do you humans do with this place you call a shed? He sounded intrigued. It is a place for interests, where the future can be founded, Tiffany said, and a place where those who have lived many years may remember. I have many memories, said the king, but I did not know that you had the power to offer me new entertainments, to draw me to new pleasures. Very few in this world or others are able to do so. And now, Tiffany thought, the king of the elves did see her as more than a young girl. At this meeting she had respect. But he deserved respect too, so she bowed her head towards him just a little. May I apologize for the hotheads in my kingdom, he continued lazily, his voice smooth and delicious. I find them a large annoyance, quite possibly as you do. He glared at the quivering peas blossom, and then at the corpse of Nightshade. You, elf, you killed my queen, my Lady Nightshade, just for spite, he growled. And the king of the elves brought himself upright and smacked Peaseblossom with a hand that killed, leaving the carcass just lying there, his careless and casual use of violence shocking Tiffany, despite all she knew of elves. I'm sorry I had to do that, he said. But they don't understand anything else. The universe turns, alas. It turns, and we have to accommodate change or move on. This is a good world we had here, mistress, the king said now. He shrugged. It's a shame about the iron. But perhaps as the universe turns, Mistress Tiffany, we might meet again. On a different turn and in more happy circumstances. Yes, said Tiffany. We might. Now, be gone from my land. Her voice was hard, and in the air there was the piercing sound of a whistle, with an answering screech as the early morning train left Two Shirts station. Listen, Your Majesty. That is the song of the 525 for Lanka, and that is your future, my lord. A lifetime of metal if you stay.
These mechanisms are interesting. There are tools in my shed, and I wonder if such trains could perhaps be made without iron, said the king, adding wistfully, I am a man of magic, so I should be able to have anything I want.
But you can't, said Tiffany. The railways are not for you. And it seemed to her, as he left, that the King of the Elves was looking thoughtful. As the final elves slipped away to limp back to their land, she turned to Rob Anybody. Rob, let us bury the Lady Nightshade here, where she fell, she said quietly. I will mark the spot with a cairn of stones. We will remember this day. We will remember her. Then she added softly, almost to herself, We need to remember. Chapter 19. Peace. As the morning flowed into the day, the Feagles were settling down to a feast of drinking, eating, and more drinking, and telling tales, some of which were bigger than the Feagles themselves. Rob Anybody looked at Tiffany and said, Weel, noo, mistress, the field is oor ain. Come on doon into the mound. Jeanie would love to see your sonsy face. And Tiffany slid into the mound, which seemed bigger than when she had seen it last. The great hall was full of leaping figures and flying kilts as the Feagles danced their reels. Feagles loved a reel at any time. The slap of boot on earth was like a challenge to the universe. Then, of course, every Feagle wanted every other Feagle to know how well they had conducted themselves against the elves. Every single one of the younger Feagles was wanting Tiffany, their Hag of the Hills, to know how brave he had been. As they gathered around, she said, What are your names, boys? Wee Callum, a little bit tongue-tied, said, I'm Callum, mistress. Pleased to meet you, said Tiffany. Aye, mistress, and this is my brother, Callum. Two of you, she said. Isn't that difficult? Och, no. I know who I am, and he knows who he is, and so does our other brother, Callum. And how did you like the fighting? Och, aye, we smited them weel enough. The big man is a hard taskmaster, ye ken. He sees to it that we can handle the mace and the spear and the axe, and of course the feats. And when the three of us got one of they scunners doon on the ground, that's what our boots were for. The old boys were marching down the lane, and they had a new song now, one that began, our soul, a soldier's life for me. And with each verse and each step, they were standing straighter and stronger. Our soul, a soldier's life for me, for king, and constabulary. We weaken the enemies, for they don't want it up 'em, they don't want it up 'em, don't want it up and over. And those who had wives kissed them. The wives hadn't seen their husbands so frisky for years. And then they set off down to the pub to tell their mates all about it. With a pint resting happily in his hand, Captain Makepeace sat on a milestone outside the pub and declaimed, People of Lanka, we happy few, we extremely elderly few, have scorned the horrible elves. They say that old men forget, but we won't. Not by a long chalk. We thought we were old, but today we found we were still young. And then it was time for another round of drinks. And another, with everyone wanting to stand the old boys around until standing was no longer an option. And still the shout went up, was there time for another flagon? As the moon rose to herald the hours of darkness the following day, there was Geoffrey on his broomstick, which was once again hovering in the air. Tiffany shouted over at him, I still don't know how you can do that. No idea, Tiffany. Can't everyone, he replied. Let's ask, for here comes everyone. And, indeed, now the other witches were arriving, led by Nanny Og and Magrat. It was time to look to the future once again, a future not now filled with elves. But the present? Well, the present was filled with the chattering and gossiping of witches as the tales of the two battles were shared. Rob Anybody had set fire to a beacon, and Tiffany watched the last witches circling until there was space, then coming into land one after the other. Not one left her stick hovering, though. It seemed as if Geoffrey was the only one who could make his broomstick do that. "I wonder if they're going to sneak back," said Nanny Og, after a while. "You can't trust old Harry. He was trying to charm you, Tiff, by what you say." "I know, but I am not charmed," said Tiffany. "Not since the one elf who tried to be a good elf is now dead.
We marked the spot where we bedded her, Nanny, you know. and if they do try to come back, we will be ready for them. We can put iron on the stones here on the chalk, like you've laid swarf all around the dancers in Lanka." Her voice hardened. "There is iron in my soul now, and iron in dealing with them should they dare ever to return." "Well," said Magrat the Queen, "we've knocked them down so often now that I think he means what he said. I think it's unlikely they will come back."
"I'll drink to them not coming back, then," said Nanny Og.
"Ladies, while we are gathered," said Tiffany, "I want to talk to you about Geoffrey. He has been a great strength to us, and I know you all saw how he made the old men of Lanka into a fighting force. He is clever and cunning and careful. He knows how to listen, and he has a kind of magic."
"That's true," said Nanny. "Everybody likes Geoffrey. Somehow he seems to understand everybody. Believe me, even some of them old girls would be quite happy to have him deal with their aches and pains and worse.
He calms people, you all know that. He is calm itself, and the calm stays even when he is left. He doesn't just jolly people up. After he is gone, they are somehow much better, as if life was still worth having. People like that, like Geoffrey, well, they make the world, well, better."
"I totally agree with you," said Mrs. Earwig.
"You agrees with me?" said Nanny Og, almost speechless.
"Yes, my dear, I do."
And Tiffany thought, "At last we will have peace."
"Thank you, Geoffrey," she said under her breath.
"Now we are all here," she said aloud, "I must tell you that I can't manage Granny's steading. I'm not going to sleep in Granny's bed any more, because I'm not her."
Nanny grinned. "I wondered if you'd do that, Tiff. You has to be your own woman after all."
"My roots are in the chalk, and the chalk is my strength," Tiffany continued. "My bones will be part of those hills, just like those of my Granny Aching."
There was a murmur from the witches. They had all heard of Granny Aching by now.
"And I have some very good boots, too. Just as I cannot sleep in Granny Weatherwax's bed, I cannot wear her boots either."
Nanny chuckled. "I'll collect them when I'm next up at the cottage, Tiff. I knows Esme's boots. Knows a young witch they'll do very nicely for."
"Talking of young witches," Tiffany added, "Miss Tick has found me some girls with potential. May I send them up to the mountains to begin their training? I will have need of help in the chalk in the future."
The witches were nodding, "Of course," for it was the way it was done. The young girls, Nancy Upright and Becky Pardon, would spend time with the senior witches and learn the beginning of their trade.
Tiffany took a deep breath. "And what I suggest is that Geoffrey be allowed to look after Granny Weatherwax's cottage and steading for me," she said, looking at Nanny Og as she said that, and getting a wink in return. She glanced at Mrs. Earwig, and was surprised to see her nod and say, "He's a very nice, decent young man, and we have seen him at work, and now we live in the tame of the railways, so perhaps we should change our ways. Yes, I believe Mr. Geoffrey should take care of Granny's, Tiffany's, steading in Lanka. He's no witch, but he's certainly much more than the usual sort of back-house boy." And Tiffany could see Mrs. Earwig's mind working, and she felt certain that the next time she saw the witch, she would have a lad somewhere around her establishment. Out loud, Nanny said, "What did you call him, Tiff? A calm weaver? Shall we leave it at that for now?" But Magrat wanted her say too. "Ference heard of what he did for the old men," she said. "He believes he should have a reward, and I think I know exactly what would suit." And thus, a few weeks later, Lord Swivel was most surprised to see his third son riding proudly up his long, long drive, a herald at his side, Sean Og, in another of his royal duties, and a pennant with the royal insignia of Lanka fluttering in the breeze. The same insignia was also on a velvet coat over the flanks of Mephistopheles.
"May I announce his royal ambassadorship, Geoffrey Swivel," proclaimed the herald, breaking into a few notes on the trumpet he held. Geoffrey's mother sobbed with delight, while his father, a man on whom no calm weaving would ever work, boiled inside with fury as he had to bow to the son he had treated as a nobody. But no one argued with the power of a crown. There was a purpose to this visit, though. After the usual bowing, scraping, and general knee-bending any royal emissary took as his due, Geoffrey grinned around at the assembled company and said, "Father, I have exciting news.
Those of us in the country may oft feel neglected by those in the big city, but let me assure you this is not the case. There have, in fact, been important developments just recently in the field of chicken runs. Some young people in Ankh-Morpork, young people whose parents have the power to indulge their wishes, and he tapped his nose with a finger to show that he expected his father to know these important parents, feel that it may no longer be necessary to hunt sly old Mr. Reynard to protect our chickens. He beamed. They have come up with a new chicken run which is totally impervious to foxes, and you, father, are the lucky, lucky landowner who has been chosen to test this new design. As his father spluttered, and his brother Hugh shouted, "Hurrah!" for no particular reason except that it felt like someone should, Geoffrey looked around. He could see his mother's face. Normally, she looked like someone the world had trodden on so many times that it was almost an invitation to tread on her yourself, but now she stood tall, her chin high. "Harold, our son has worked wonders, and here is a king honouring him and treating him as a friend," she said proudly. "Don't you look at me like that, Harold, for today I have spoken, and the Queen of Lanka has invited me to come and visit her," she added with satisfaction. There was a bleat from Mephistopheles, and as Geoffrey's father turned to stamp away, the goat turned its back and aimed a square set of devilish hooves right onto Lord Swivel's rump, followed by a raucous fart that almost, but not quite, covered up the noise of the man falling flat on his face. "A most usefully offensive goat," Geoffrey murmured to MacTavish, who'd come to stand by his side. The old stable lad looked around. "And one your father cannot touch," he said with a wink. "Not with that fancy coat on its back," he sniffed. "My word, though, Mephistopheles isn't easy on the nose. He whiffs even worse than I remember."
"Yes," said Geoffrey, "but he can climb trees and use a privy, even count. He's a strange creature. He can turn a dark day into a clear one. Look into his eyes sometime."
And MacTavish looked, and then hastily looked away. Epilogue. A Whisper on the Chalk. 2 days after the battle, Tiffany led one of the farm horses up to the hills above the farm. It was a perfect early autumn's day. There was a wonderful cerulean sky, buzzards screaming overhead, and a clear view towards the distant mountains of Lanka, their tops still covered in snow even at this time of year. There were always a handful of sheep up in this part of the downs, whatever the weather. At this time of year, there were half-grown lambs kicking their heels and chasing about while the ewes grazed nearby. Here was a well-known landmark for those who knew, a special place for sheep and farmers alike, the place where Granny Aching now lay beneath the turf. Only the iron wheels of her hut and the old pot-bedded stove with its chimney were still visible, but the ground was holy. Tiffany came to look at it every time she felt the world grinding her down, and here, where the wind never stopped blowing, she felt she could deal with anything. With the help of the horse and a strong rope, Tiffany hauled the rusty wheels out of the turf where they had been embedded and painstakingly greased and coaxed them back together. Rob Anybody had watched her for a while after she had rebuffed his offer to help, then departed with a puzzled look on his face, muttering about geezes and what he'd like to do to them. The following day, Tiffany went to visit old Mr. Block, the local carpenter. He had once made her a doll's house when she was a little girl. Now she had a bigger home in mind. He was pleased to see her, but was startled when he discovered what she wanted from him. "Mr. Block, I would like you to teach me to be a carpenter. I am going to build myself a hut, a shepherding hut." The carpenter was a kindly man and offered to help. "You are a witch," he said. "I'm a carpenter. A little hut like that wouldn't take me long. Your granny was very good to our family, and you helped my sister Margaret. I'd be happy to do it for you." But Tiffany was very definite. "That's nice of you," she said, "but all the work on this hut must be done by me. It will be mine from top to bottom, and I will pull it to where the larks rise. And I'll still be a witch when anyone should call, but there I will live. On my own," she thought to herself, "for now, anyway, for who knew what the future might bring." And her hand crept to her pocket, where she had Preston's latest letter to save her. And so Tiffany learned carpentry every evening after her day's work was done. It took her some weeks to finish it, but eventually there was a new shepherd's hut stationed close to Granny Aching's grave. There were three steps up to its wooden door, a horseshoe and a tuft of sheep's wool, the sign of a shepherd, already nailed in place there. And the roof arched over a small living space into which she had built a bed, a little cupboard, a few shelves and a space for a washbasin. From the bed she could see out of a small window, see clear across the downs right to the horizon. And she could see the sun rise and set, and the moon dance through its guises, the magic of every day that was no less magic for that. She loaded up the old farm horse again with the bedding from her little room in the farmhouse and her few possessions, said goodbye to her parents, and headed up the hill in the late afternoon sun. "Are you sure, Jigget, this is what you really want?" said her father. "Yes, it is," Tiffany replied. Her mother cried and handed her a new quilt and a freshly baked loaf of bread to go with the cheese Tiffany had made that morning. Halfway up the hill, Tiffany turned to look down at the farm and saw her parents still arm in arm. She waved and carried on climbing without looking back again. It had been a long day. They were always long days. Later that evening, once she had made her little bed in the hut, she went out to collect some kindling. The white cat, Ewe, followed close behind. The little tracks of the chalk were very familiar to Tiffany. She had walked along them with Granny Aching years ago. And as she reached the wood at the top of the rise, Tiffany thought she saw somebody walking through the dusky shadows under the trees. Not just one person alone. There seemed to be two figures, both strangely familiar. Beside them, alert to every gesture, every nod, every whistle, trotted two sheepdogs. Granny Weatherwax, Tiffany thought, side by side with Granny Aching, thunder and lightning at their heels. And the little words in her head came unbidden. "You are the shepherd's crown, Jigget. You are the shepherd's crown." One of the figures looked over and gave her a brief nod, whilst the other paused and bowed her head. Tiffany bowed back, solemnly, respectfully, and then the figures were gone. On the way back to the hut, Tiffany looked down at the cat and, on a sudden impulse, spoke to it. "Where is Granny Weatherwax, you?" There was a pause, and the cat made a long meow, which appeared to end meow everywhere, and then purred just like any other cat, and rubbed her hard little head against Tiffany's leg. Tiffany thought of the little spot in the woods where Granny Weatherwax lay, remembered, and knew that you had been right. Granny Weatherwax was indeed here and there. She was, in fact, and always would be, everywhere. There was a long stream of visitors to the shepherding hut once it became known that Tiffany was back on the chalk for good. Joe Aching came up to deliver some messages and a new letter from Preston and bring Tiffany some things her mother had decided she needed. He looked around the neat little hut with approval. Tiffany had made the space very comfortable. He looked at the books on the shelf and smiled. Tiffany had left Granny Aching's Diseases of the Sheep at the farm, but both Flowers of the Chalk and the Good Child's Book of Fairy Tales had their place by the little shepherd's crown he had given her. On the back of the door was a wooden peg on which hung her witch's hat. "I reckon you'll find some use for this too," her father said, as he took a bottle of special sheep's liniment, made according to Granny Aching's recipe, out of his pocket and placed it on the shelf. Tiffany laughed and hoped her father hadn't heard the cry of "Crivens!" from the roof of the hut. He looked up as some dust fell down from where Big Jan sat on Daft Woolly to silence him. "I hope you haven't got woodworm already, Tiff." She laughed again as she gave him a hug to say goodbye. Mr. Block was an early visitor too. He puffed his way up the hill and found her settled in with Ewe the cat sitting on her lap while she sorted rags. Tiffany watched nervously as the old carpenter looked around and under the hut with a professional eye. When he had finished, she gave him a cup of tea and asked him what he thought. "You've done well, lass. Very well. I have never seen a boy apprentice take to carpentry as quickly as this, and you are a girl." "Not a girl," Tiffany said. "I'm a witch." And she looked down to the little cat beside her and said, "That's so, isn't it, you?" Mr. Block looked at her suspiciously for a moment. "So, did you use magic to make the hut, miss?"
I didn't have to, said Tiffany. The magic was already here. The end. 1948 to 2015. Afterward. The Shepherd's Crown is Terry Pratchett's final novel. It was written in his last year before he finally succumbed in early 2015 to the embuggerance of posterior cortical atrophy. Terry had been diagnosed back in 2007, the year that he wrote Nation. At that time, Terry thought he might have less than 2 years to live, and that brought a new urgency to his writing. He had never been a slouch in this respect, but now things were measured by the cost in writing time. If demands for his presence took him away from writing, it had to be really worthwhile, such as feeding the chickens or attending to his tortoises. He had so many more books he wanted to write. It says a lot for Terry's resilience and determination not to go down without a fight that he wrote 5 more full-length best-selling novels between Nation and The Shepherd's Crown, as well as collaborating with Stephen Baxter on 5 Long Earth novels. And Terry was still developing new ideas for books right up to his final few months. We will not now know how the old folk of Twilight Canyons solve the mystery of a missing treasure and defeat the rise of a Dark Lord despite their failing memories, nor the secret of the Crystal Cave and the carnivorous plants in the Dark Inn continent, nor how Constable Feeney solves a whodunit amongst the congenitally decent and honest goblins, nor how the second book about the redoubtable Morris as a ship's cat might have turned out. And these are just a few of the ideas his office and family know about. Terry usually had more than one book on the go at a time, and he discovered what each was about as he went along. He would start somewhere, telling himself the story as he wrote it, writing the bits he could see clearly and assembling it all into a whole, like a giant literary jigsaw, when he was done. Once it was shaped, he would keep writing it too, adding to it, fixing bits, constantly polishing and adding linking sequences, tossing in just one more footnote or event. His publishers often had to prize the manuscript away from him, as there was always more he felt he could do, even though by then he would be well into the next story which was tugging at his elbow. Eventually, the book was sent to the printer, and reluctantly, Terry would let it go. Terry had been thinking about the key elements in Tiffany Aching and Granny Weatherwax's last story for a few years. He wrote the pivotal scenes while he was still writing Raising Steam, and then rewrote them several times as he shaped the rest of The Shepherd's Crown around them. The Shepherd's Crown has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and all the bits in between. Terry wrote all of those. But even so, it was, still, not quite as finished as he would have liked when he died. If Terry had lived longer, he would almost certainly have written more of this book. There are things we all wish we knew more about. But what we have is a remarkable book. Terry's final book. And anything you wish to know more about in here, you're welcome to imagine yourself. Rob Wilkins, May 2015, Salisbury, UK. Acknowledgements. Despite the effects of his Alzheimer's disease, Terry wanted to keep writing as long as possible, and was able to do so not least through the assistance of his fine editorial team. Lynn, Rihanna and Rob would most especially like to thank Philippa Dickinson and Sue Cook for their tireless help and encouragement that kept the words flowing. A Feagle Glossary, adjusted for those of a delicate disposition. A work in progress by Miss Perspicacia Tick, Witch. Big jobs, human beings. Big man, chief of the clan, usually the husband of the Kelder. Blethers, rubbish, nonsense. Boogle, see Schemey. Boggin, to be desperate, as in, I'm boggin for a cup of tea. Bros, porridge with a drop of strong drink added, or more than a drop. Be warned, it will put hairs on your chest. Bunty, a weak person. Carlin, old woman. Cludgy, the privy. Corbies, big black birdies known by most people as crows. Crivens,
a general exclamation that can mean anything from "my goodness" to "I've just lost my temper and there is going to be trouble." Dree, your, my, his, her, weird. Facing the fate that is in store for you, me, him, her. Een, eyes. Eldritch, weird, strange. Sometimes means oblong, too, for some reason. Fash, worry, upset. Geese, a very important obligation backed up by tradition and magic. Not a bird. Gonagall, the bard of the clan, skilled in music and stories. Hag, a witch, of any age. Hagger hags, a very important witch. Hagging, haggling, anything a witch does. Hidlins, secrets. Kelda, the female head of the clan, and eventually the mother of most of it. Fegal babies are very small, and a Kelda will have hundreds in her lifetime. Lang Syne, long ago. Last world, the Fegals believe that they are dead. This world is so filled with all they like, they argue, that they must have been really good in a past life and then died and ended up here. Appearing to die here means merely going back to the last world, which they believe is rather dull. Maupi, furry animals with white tufts as tails, making them easy to spot. Sometimes called rabbits. Good to eat, especially with a dab of snail relish on the side. Mudlin, useless person. Pished. I'm assured that this means tired. Schemy, an unpleasant person. Scuggan, a really unpleasant person. Scunner, a generally unpleasant person. Ships, woody things that eat grass and go bar, easily confused with the other kind. Spavey, see Mudlin. Special sheep liniment, probably moonshine whiskey, I'm very sorry to say. A favourite of the Fegals, do not try to make this at home. Spog, a small leather bag at the front of a Fegal's kilt, which covers whatever he presumably thinks needs to be hidden, and generally holds things like something he is halfway through eating, something he'd found now that therefore belongs to him, and whatever he was using as a handkerchief, which might not necessarily be dead. Steamy, only found in the big Fegal mounds in the mountains, where there's enough water to allow regular bathing. It's a kind of sauna. Fegals on the chalk tend to rely on the fact that you can only get so much dirt on you before it starts to fall off of its own accord. Whaley, a general cry of despair. That is the end of The Shepherd's Crown. It was written by Terry Pratchett and read by Stephen Briggs.